Sultan Mehmed II and his army, which had assembled there to attack Wallachia. In this raid, Dracula killed several thousand Turkish soldiers, and the Sultan barely escaped with his life before the Ottoman guard forced the Wallachians into a retreat. Later, I wandered into the English Literature Division and was glad to find the library owned a copy of Bram Stoker's Dracula. In fact, it would take me quite a few visits to read it. I gradually allowed Stoker's alternating Gothic horror and cozy Victorian love stories to engulf me. What I wanted from the book, I didn't quite know. The courtly, repulsive Count Dracula of the novel was a compelling figure, I thought, even if he didn't have much in common with Vlad Tepes. But Rossi himself had been convinced that Dracula had become one of the undead in life. Professor Rossi had said that Stoker had turned up lots of sound information about vampire lore. I had never even seen a vampire movie. My father did not like horror of any sort, and the conventions of the story were new to me. According to Stoker, a vampire could attack his victims only between sunset and sunrise. The vampire lived indefinitely, feasting on the blood of mortals and thereby converting them to his own undead state. He could take the form of bat, or wolf, or mist. He could be repelled by the use of garlic blossoms, or a crucifix. He could be destroyed if you drove a stake through his heart and filled his mouth with garlic while he slept in his coffin during the daylight. A silver bullet through the heart could also destroy him. My father was longing more than ever, he said, for the South in spring. He wanted me to see its beauties, too. My vacation was coming soon anyway, and his meetings in Paris would detain him only a few days. I had learned not to press him, either for travel or for stories. When he was ready, the next would come, but never, never when we were at home. I believe that he didn't want to bring that dark presence directly into our house. We took the train to Paris and later a car south into the Cévennes. That road led us through the southeast and then, a blurred day or two later, up into the cooler mountains. Les Pyrénées Orientales, my father told me, unfolding the road map across one of our picnics. He wanted to see a particular monastery.
I've been wanting to come back down here for years. I think we can reach the town at its foot by tonight and walk up there tomorrow.
Is it high up?
It's about halfway up the mountains, which protected it from all sorts of invaders. It was built just at the year 1000. Incredible, this little place carved into a rock, difficult for even the most enthusiastic pilgrims to reach. But you'll like the town below it just as much.
I did like Les Bains when we drove into it that afternoon. It was a large sand-colored rock village spread over one small peak. The Great Pyrenees hung above it, shadowing all but its broadest lower streets, which stretched toward river valleys and the dry, flat farms below. We dined heartily on a soup something like gazpacho, and then on veal cutlets in the first-floor restaurant of one of the town's 19th-century hotels. The restaurant manager put one foot on the brass rail of the bar next to our table and asked idly, yet courteously, about our travels.
Ah, of course, a monastery. You know that Saint-Mathieu draws 8,000 visitors every summer?
Yes, it really does.
There are lots of legends in this place, some remarkable ones, and all true. I shall tell you one. You don't mind? Please, eat your cutlet. It's best very hot. I am proud to say they call me the historian of our town. Eat, eat. Our monastery was founded in the year 1000, you know already. When the monastery and its little church were just a century old, one of the most pious monks died mysteriously in middle age. He was called Miguel de Cuja. They mourned him terribly, and he was buried in the crypt. Soon after that, a curse came over the monastery. Several monks died of a strange plague. They were found dead one by one in the cloisters. Oh, the cloisters are beautiful. You will love them. They are the most beautiful in Europe. So the dead monks were found white as ghosts, as if they had no blood in their veins. Everyone suspected poisons. Finally, one young monk went down into the crypt and dug up his teacher, against the wishes of the abbot, who was very frightened, and they found the teacher alive, but not really alive, if you know what I mean. A living death. He was rising at night to take the lives of his fellow monks. In order to send the poor man's soul up to the right place, they brought holy water from a shrine in the mountains and got a very sharp stick and...
He made a dramatic shape in the air so I would understand the sharpness of the object. At that moment, my father's fork clinked against his plate. When I looked up, I saw he was as white as the tablecloth, staring at our new friend. He cleared his throat and wiped his mouth with his napkin once or twice.
Could we have coffee?
The lowest of the dusty squares was full of thrumming loudspeaker music when we emerged. Some kind of local show was in progress, in the form of 10 or 12 children in costumes that reminded me of Carmen. We lingered only a few minutes before turning onto the road upward, the one that led so clearly out of the square to the church at the top. My father said nothing about the rapidly sinking sun, but I felt our pace was set by the day's sudden death, and I wasn't surprised when all the light in that wild country plunged away from it suddenly. The view from the foot of the church wall was enormous, not dizzying like the views we'd caught in those Italian towns I still dreamed about, but vast. Plains and hills gathering themselves into foothills, and foothills rearing up into dark peaks that blocked out whole portions of the distant world. Swallows flew in and out of the church tower, wheeling as if outlining something invisible with filaments of air. I noticed one that cartwheeled drunkenly among the rest, weightless and awkward instead of swift, and realized it was a single bat, just visible against the faltering light. My father sighed and put one foot up on a block of stone. This time, I didn't have to ask him to go on with our story. It was as if he preferred it, for now, to something worse.
December 13th, 1930. Trinity College, Oxford. My dear and unfortunate successor. I take some comfort today in the fact that this date is dedicated in the church calendar to Lucia, Saint of Light, a holy presence carted home by Viking traders from southern Italy. To resume my account of my research. I changed my travel plans last summer to include Istanbul, and I changed them under the influence of one small piece of parchment. I had examined every source I could find at Oxford and in London that might pertain to the Dracula of my mysterious blank book. I had every intention of dropping this pointless research, this chase after a random sign in a randomly discovered book, on the eve of my departure for Greece. But as usual, I had prepared too diligently for my travels. I was ahead of myself. I had a little time before my last sleep and the morning train. I could stop one last time in the rare book room, which would be open until 9. There was a file I intended to try there, an entry under Ottoman that had struck me as pertaining to precisely the period of Vlad Dracula's life. The boxed file, which I found without difficulty, contained 4 or 5 flattened short scrolls of Ottoman workmanship, all part of an 18th-century gift to the university. Each scroll was covered with Arabic calligraphy. An English description at the front of the file assured me that this was no treasure trove as far as I was concerned. 3 of the scrolls were inventories of taxes levied on the peoples of Anatolia by Sultan Mehmed II. The last of them listed taxes collected from the cities of Sarajevo and Skopje, a little closer to Wallachia, but still a distant part of empire from his, in that day and time. As I gathered the parchment to return them to their cardboard file, however, a bit of writing on the back of that last one caught my eye. It was a short list, a casual graffito, an ancient doodle. I read it curiously. It appeared to be a record of expenses. The object purchased had been noted down on the left, and the cost, in an unspecified currency, noted neatly down on the right. The final entry made the hair rise along my arm as I held that aging parchment up. Maps and military records from the Order of the Dragon, 12. How, you ask, could I take all this in at a glance when my knowledge of Arabic is as crude as I've already confessed? This scrawl was written out in Latin. Below it, a faintly scratched date seared the thing into my brain. 1490. In 1490, I recalled, the Order of the Dragon lay in ruins, crushed by Ottoman might. Vlad Dracula was 14 years dead and buried, according to legend, in the monastery at Lake Snagov. Was my merchant a Balkan traveller, Latin writing, speaking some Slav or Latinate dialect? Whoever he was, I blessed his dust for jotting down those expenses. If he had sent off the caravan of spoils without incident, and if it had reached the Sultan safely, and if, least likely of all, it had survived in the Sultan's treasure house of jewels, I went to the desk, where the librarian was checking through a drawer. "Excuse me, do you have a listing of historical archives by country? Archives in Turkey, for example?"
"We don't have it here. The central library desk can show it to you. They open tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning."
My train to London, I remembered, didn't leave until 10:14. It would take only 10 minutes or so to glance through the possibilities. And if Sultan Mehmed II's name or the names of his immediate successors appeared among any of the possibilities, well, I hadn't wanted to see Rhodes so very badly, after all. Yours in profoundest grief, Bartholomew Rossi.
Time seemed to have stopped in the high-vaulted library hall, despite the activity all around me. I had read one whole letter, but there were at least four more in the pile beneath it. I was just wondering if I should gather up all of this work and walk home to continue there later, when a young woman approached and seated herself at one end of the table. I saw, looking around, that the surrounding catalog tables were full to capacity and strewn with other people's books, typescripts, card catalog drawers, and notepads. She had no other place to sit, I realized, but I felt suddenly protective of Rossi's documents. I was just about to gather the papers together when I noticed the book the young woman had propped up in front of her. She was already flipping through the center section of it, a notebook and pen lying ready at her elbow. I glanced from the book's title to her face, in astonishment, and then at the other book she had set down nearby. Then I looked back at her face. It was a young face, but already aging very slightly and handsomely, with the light crinkling of skin I recognized around my own eyes in the mirror every morning, a barely veiled fatigue. So I knew she must be a graduate student. It was also an elegant, angular face that wouldn't have been out of place in a medieval altar painting. Her dark, almost sooty hair sprang away from her forehead with more vigor than was fashionable in those tightly groomed days. The title of her reading in this place of myriad inquiry, I looked again astonished, was The Carpathians. Under her dark-sweatered elbow rested Bram Stoker's Dracula. "Excuse me, I couldn't help noticing your books, I mean, what you're reading." She stared unhelpfully back at me, keeping Dracula open in front of her, and raised the dark sweep of her eyebrows. "You see, I'm actually studying the same subject." Her eyebrows rose a little higher, but I indicated the papers in front of me. "No, really, I've got these letters here from an unusual historical source, and they mention Dracula. They're about Dracula."
A faint interest dawned inside her gaze. She slumped slightly in her chair, relaxed into something like masculine ease without taking her hands off her book.
"What are those letters, exactly?"
I thought with regret that I should have introduced myself and my credentials before getting into any of this. For some reason, I felt I couldn't start over at this point. "I'm working with someone who's having some problems, and he wrote these letters more than 20 years ago. He gave them to me thinking I might be able to help him out of his current situation, which has to do with... he was studying..."
"I see."
She stood up and started collecting her books, deliberately and without haste. Now she was picking up her briefcase. Standing, she looked as tall as I'd imagined her, a little sinewy, with broad shoulders. "Why are you studying Dracula?"
"Well, I must say it is not any of your business. But I am planning a future trip, although I do not know when I will take it."
I felt suddenly rattled by the whole conversation. To the Carpathians?
No.
She flung the last words back at me disdainfully. And then, as if she couldn't help herself, but so contemptuously that I didn't dare follow her.
To Istanbul.
December 14th, 1930. Trinity College, Oxford. My dear and unfortunate successor. On my journey from England to Greece, I experienced some of the smoothest travelling I've ever known. The director of the museum in Crete was actually at the dock to welcome me. I had easy access to every collection I approached, including some private ones. In the afternoons, when the museums shut down and the town took its siesta, I sat on my lovely vine-shaded balcony, fleshing out my notes. Under these idyllic circumstances, I considered dropping entirely what now seemed to me to be a morbid fancy, the pursuit of that peculiar word, Dracula. But something, an historian's passion for thoroughness, or maybe sheer love of the chase, compelled me to stick to my plans, and to go on to Istanbul for a few days.
I read every word. That letter told me again about Rossi's chilling experience among the documents of Sultan Mehmed II's collection, his finding there a map labeled in three languages, the map's theft by a sinister bureaucrat, and the two tiny, blistered wounds on the bureaucrat's neck. There were three letters left, and I went on to the next one eagerly.
December 15th, 1930, Trinity College, Oxford. My dear and unfortunate successor. From the moment the ugly official snatched away that map, my luck failed. On my return to my rooms, I found that the hotel manager had moved my belongings to a smaller and rather dirtier chamber, because one corner of the ceiling had fallen in my own. During this process, some of my papers had disappeared. Sitting in my cramped new quarters, I tried at once to resurrect my notes on Vlad Dracula's history and the maps I had seen in the archives from memory. Then I hurried away from that place back into Greece, where I attempted to resume my studies on Crete, since I now had extra time at my disposal. The boat trip to Crete was horrendous, the sea being very high and rough. My American colleagues had departed. The kindly director of the museum had fallen ill, and no one seemed to remember his having invited me to the opening of a tomb. I tried to go on with my writing about Crete, but searched my notes in vain for inspiration. My nervousness was hardly appeased by the primitive superstitions I encountered even among townspeople, superstitions I hadn't noticed on previous trips, although they are so widespread in Greece that I must have come across them before. The old men in Crete's tavernas seemed much more inclined to tell me their 210 vampire stories than they were to explain where I might find other shards of pottery like that one. One evening, I let a stranger buy me a round of a local speciality called, whimsically, amnesia, with the result that I was sick all the next day. Nothing, in fact, went well with me until after I reached England, which I did in a terrible rainy gale that caused me the most gruesome seasickness I have ever experienced. When I arrived in Oxford, I was exhausted, dejected, fearful. In my mirror, I looked pale and thin. Sometimes I had the sense, which haunted me almost to madness, of some purpose unfulfilled. I was lonely and full of longing. In a word, my nerves were in a state I'd never known before. Of course, I attempted to carry on as usual, saying nothing of these matters to anyone, and preparing for the upcoming term with my usual care. For the first month after my return, I tried not only to stifle all memory of my unpleasant journey, but also to avoid any renewal of my interest in the odd little book in my luggage, or in the research it had precipitated. However, my confidence reasserting itself, and my curiosity growing again, perversely, within me, I picked up the volume one evening, and reassembled my notes from England and Istanbul. The consequence, and from then on I did view it as a consequence, was immediate, terrifying, and tragic. I must pause here, brave reader. I cannot bring myself to write more for the moment. I beg you not to desist in these readings, but to pursue them further, as I will try to myself, tomorrow. Yours in profoundest grief, Bartholomew Rossi.
My father had been to the region of Emona once before our visit, and to Ragusa several times. He had visited Massimo and Giulia's stone villa for other happy suppers in other years, but at Saint Mathieu I sensed that he had actually longed for this place. He did not tell me now, except to recognize aloud the curve of the road before it finally ran up against the abbey wall, and to know later which door opened into sanctuary, cloister, or finally crypt. This memory for detail was nothing new to me. I had seen him reach for the right door in famous old churches before, or take the correct turn to the ancient refectory. The difference at Saint Mathieu was a difference of alertness. Instead of seeming to say to himself, "Ah, there's that fine tympanum above the doors, I thought I remembered it was on this side," my father appeared to be checking off views he could already have described with his eyes closed. I was sure he had not merely seen this place before, camera in hand. Something, I felt sure, had happened to him here. My second impression was as fleeting as my first, but sharper. When he opened the pamphlet and put one foot on the stone threshold, I saw that he hadn't lost some old emotion for the sanctuary we were about to enter. That emotion was either grief or fear, or some terrible blend of the two. Saint-Mathieu-des-Pyrénées-Orientales sits at a height of 4,000 feet above sea level, and the sea is not as distant as this walled-in landscape with its wheeling eagles would have you believe. Red-roofed and precariously high at the summit, it seems to have grown directly out of a single pinnacle of mountain rock. Inside lies the tiny abbey church of Saint-Mathieu and its wonderfully delicate cloister, hedged in by rose bushes even at that tremendous altitude. When I went to the outside edge of the cloisters and sat down on a low wall there, I could look out over a drop of several thousand feet and see thin mountain waterfalls white against the vertical blue forest.
The cloistered life.
My father settled down next to me on the wall. His face was strange, and he put one arm around my shoulders, something he rarely did.
It looks peaceful, but it's very hard. And wicked, sometimes, too.
He frowned, stood up, and swung away. It struck me that he regretted, almost to tears, our visit here.
Shall we take a tour?
It was not until we were descending the steps to the crypt that I saw again in my father that indescribable attitude of fear. We had finished our attentive pacing through cloisters and chapels. The crypt was the last item on our self-guided tour, dessert for the morbid, as my father said in some churches. At a yawning stairwell, he seemed to go forward a little too deliberately, keeping me behind him without even raising an arm as we stepped down into the hold of the rock. Candles interrupted the darkness from stone sconces on the heavy pillars. A cross had been cut into the wall of the apse. It hovered, like a shadow, above a stone altar or sarcophagus. It was hard to tell which. Along the sides of the crypt lay two or three other sarcophagi, small and primitive, unmarked.
The resting place of the founding abbot and of several later abbots. And that completes our tour. All right, let's go get some lunch.
I paused on the way out. The urge to ask my father what he knew about Saint Mathieu, what he remembered even, came over me in a wave, almost a panic. But his back, broad in a black linen jacket, said as clearly as spoken words,
"Wait. Everything in its time."
December 16th, 1930. Trinity College, Oxford. My dear and unfortunate successor. As I have related, I eventually picked up my strange book again, like a man compelled by an addiction. I told myself before I did it that my life had returned to normal, that my experience in Istanbul had been odd, but was surely explicable. So I picked the book up again, and I feel I should tell you about that moment in the most literal terms. It was a rainy evening in October, only 2 months ago. Term had begun, and I sat in pleasant solitude in my rooms, whiling away an hour after supper. I was waiting for my friend Hedges, a don only 10 years older than myself, of whom I was extremely fond. Except for his shyness, he could have been at home among Addison, Swift, and Pope, gathering in some London coffee-house. He had only a few friends, and fostered no dreams that reached beyond the Oxford countryside, where he liked to walk, leaning over a fence now and then to watch the cows chewing. I loved to hear about his work, which he discussed in a modest but enthusiastic way. His name was... well, you could find it in any library with a little poking around, but I will call him Hedges, a nom de guerre of my own devising, to give him in this narrative the privacy and decency that were his in life. This particular evening, Hedges was to drop by my rooms with drafts of the two articles I had squeezed out of my work at Crete. I anticipated half an hour's friendly critique, then sherry, and that gratifying moment when a true friend stretches his legs at your fireside and asks you how you've been. While I waited, I poked up the fire, added another log, and set out two glasses. Dark was coming in early already, and with it arrived a gloomy, slanting rain. I find this the most appealing kind of autumn evening, not the most dismal, so I felt only a faint shiver of premonition when my hand, searching for 10 minutes' reading, fell casually on the antique volume I had been avoiding. I'd left it tucked among less disturbing items on a shelf above my desk. I sat down there and opened the book. Immediately, I became aware of something very strange. A smell rose from its pages that was not merely the delicate scent of aging paper and cracked vellum. It was a reek of decay, a terrible, sickening odour, a smell of old meat or corrupted flesh. The little volume seemed alive in my hands, yet it smelled of death. If I had not been studiously avoiding my reaction to this unpleasant presence, I would have dropped the thing, put it away again. But now, for the first time in many weeks, I made myself turn to that extraordinary central image, the wide-winged dragon snarling over his banner. Suddenly, with jarring accuracy, I saw something afresh, and comprehended it for the first time. You will remember that there were three maps graduated in scale to show the same unnamed region in greater and greater detail. That region, even sketched in my inartistic, if careful, hand, had a most definite shape. It looked, for all the world, like a symmetrically winged beast. A long river wound away from it to the southwest, curling back, as the dragon's tail did. I studied the woodcut, my heart fluttering strangely. The dragon's tail was barbed, tipped with an arrow that pointed... Here I almost gasped aloud, forgetting all the intervening weeks of recovery from my former obsession, towards the spot that corresponded on my map to the site of the unholy tomb. The visual resemblance between the two images was too striking to be coincidence. How had I not noticed in the archive that the region represented on those maps had exactly the brooding, spread-winged shape of my dragon? The woodcut I'd puzzled over so deeply before my trip must hold a definite meaning. A message. Its tail pointed to the tomb as surely as any finger points to the self. This is me. I am here. I tasted an acrid tension like my own blood at the back of my throat. None of the maps showed Lake Snagov, where Vlad Sepes was supposed to have been buried. Surely this meant Sepes, Dracula, rested somewhere else, someplace not even legend had recorded reliably. But where? As I sat there trying to fit these pieces together, I heard the familiar sound of footsteps along the college hall, Hedges shuffling, endearing walk. I had half risen, gathering papers, when there was a sudden silence. It was like an error in music, a note held one beat too long. The familiar, good-natured steps had stopped outside my door, but Hedges hadn't knocked as he usually did. I dropped the book, hurried to the outer door of my rooms, unlocked it, and pulled it open. Hedges was there, but he lay sprawled on the polished floor, his head thrown backward, and his body twisted sideways, as if a great force had hurled him down. I realized with a thrill of nausea that I hadn't heard him cry out or fall. His eyes were open, staring hard past me. For an endless second I thought he was dead. Then his head moved, and he groaned. I crouched beside him. "Hedges!" he moaned again, and blinked rapidly. "Can you hear me?" I was almost sobbing with relief because he was alive. At that moment his head rolled convulsively, revealing a bloody gash in the side of his neck. It wasn't large, but it looked deep, as if a dog had leapt up and torn at the flesh, and it was bleeding profusely down his collar and onto the floor by his shoulder. Hedges opened his eyes and looked at me. His head listed to one side, and half his face looked slack, bluish, but he spoke intelligibly.
"He said to tell you..."
"What? Who?"
"He said to tell you he will brook no trespasses."
Hedges' head fell back, that big, fine head that sheltered one of England's best minds. The skin crawled on my arms as I held him. The university doctor who admitted him to the hospital told me Hedges had suffered a stroke along with his wound.
"Brought on by the shock. That gash on his neck looks as if it was made by something sharp. Most likely sharp teeth. An animal. You don't keep a dog, do you?"
"Of course not. They aren't permitted in college chambers." The doctor shook his head.
"Very odd."
The investigation turned up nothing satisfactory, and Hedges was incapable of testifying. One day, during a visit to his rest home, I quietly asked Hedges to think about these words. "I will brook no trespasses." He turned incurious eyes on me, touching with idle puffy fingers the red wound on his neck.
"If so, Boswell. If not, be gone."
A few days later he was dead, of a second stroke suffered during the night. When the college master came to tell me, I swore to myself that I would work tirelessly to avenge Hedges' death, if I could only figure out how. Yours in profoundest grief, Bartholomew Rossi.
Our next trip took us farther east again beyond the Julian Alps. The little town of Kostanyevitsa, place of the chestnut tree, was indeed full of chestnuts at this time of year. My father and I walked slowly along, enjoying the end of a warm autumnal day. Everything in the stores looked like everything else, and the shop clerks, too, seemed to me exactly like one another, in royal blue work coats and flowered scarves. The last meeting in Zagreb had ended at noon, while I put the finishing flourish to my history homework. I had a new short green dress and yellow knee socks, and my father was smiling over some unintelligible spoof that had passed between one diplomat and another that morning. Ahead of us lay a low stone bridge spanning the river Kostan. The river curved out of sight close to the bridge, and in its curve huddled a diminutive castle, a villa-sized Slav chateau with swans paddling below its walls and grooming themselves on the bank. In the castle park, I saw a stone bench with chestnut trees leaning over it, and the castle walls throwing a soothing shade on it. My father's clean suit would be safe there, and he might sit longer than he'd intended, and talk in spite of himself.
All the time I was looking through these letters in my apartment, something outside the whole tragic problem of Rossi's disappearance kept nagging at the back of my mind. When I put down the letter recounting his friend Hedge's gruesome accident, I felt too ill for a few moments to think clearly. In my historian's experience, the dead stayed respectably dead, the Middle Ages held real horrors, not supernatural ones, and Dracula was a colorful East European legend resurrected by the movies of my childhood. And something else nagged at me. As my brain cleared a little, I realized it was my memory of the young woman at the library, whom I'd met only a couple of hours before, although it already seemed to me days. I remembered the extraordinary light in her eyes as she had listened to my explanation of Rossi's letters, the masculine drawing together of her eyebrows in concentration. Why had she been reading about Dracula? At my table of all tables, that evening of all evenings, at my very elbow. Why had she mentioned Istanbul? I sighed and picked up Rossi's last letter. Unlike the others, it was handwritten, on lined notebook paper in a dark ink. I unfolded it.
August 19th, 1931. Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA. My dear and unfortunate successor. Well, I cannot pretend you may not be out there for me still somewhere waiting to save me if my life one day collapses. And because I have a further bit of information to add to everything you have already perused, I feel I should fill this bitter vial up to the brim. I finally doubted my own strength a few months ago, and I did so for reasons connected with Hedge's enraging and terrible end. I fled his graveside for America, almost literally. My appointment had become reality, and I was already packing my boxes at the time I took a day out in Dorset to see where he rested in peace. After I departed for America, I found myself in a new and brighter world, where the term begins earlier, and the students have an open and practical outlook unknown at Oxford. And even after all this, I could not bring myself to drop entirely my acquaintance with the undead. As a consequence, apparently, it could not bring himself to drop his acquaintance with me. You will remember that on the night Hedges was attacked, I had unexpectedly discovered the meaning of the central woodcut in my sinister book, and verified to myself that the unholy tomb on the maps I'd found in Istanbul must be the tomb of Vlad Dracula. I had spoken my remaining question aloud. Where was the tomb, then, as I had spoken aloud in the archive in Istanbul, conjuring up this second time some terrible presence, which wreaked its warning to me on my dear friend's life? I swear to you that this punishment angered me beyond terror for a time, and made me vow to ferret out the last clues, and, if my strength held, to pursue my pursuer to his lair. It seemed to me that my next task was to learn more about my strange old book, whence it had come, who had designed it, how old it was. I gave it up, reluctantly I admit, to the laboratories of the Smithsonian. They shook their heads there over the specificity of my questions, and hinted that the consultation of powers beyond their own means would cost me more. But I was stubborn, and I didn't think that a farthing of my inheritance from my grandfather or my meagre savings from Oxford should go to clothe or feed or entertain me, while Hedges lay unavenged in a churchyard that ought not to have seen his coffin for another 50 years. But it was not the brutality of what occurred next that changed my mind and brought home to me the full meaning of fear. It was the brilliance of it. My book was being handled at the Smithsonian by a bibliophiliac little person named Howard Martin, a kind, if rather taciturn, man, who had taken my cause to heart as thoroughly as if he'd known my whole story. When he had apparently done everything he could for me, he wrote to me that I could have the results, such as they were, and that he would hand the book to me in person, as I had first handed it to him, if I didn't wish it to be shipped north. I made the train trip down, appearing at his office door 10 minutes before the appointed time. Mr. Martin opened the door and ushered me in with a little smile.
"So glad you could come down."
He spoke in the flat American twang that had become, for me, the most welcoming speech in the world. When we were seated in his manuscript-filled office, I found myself facing him and was immediately shocked by the change in his appearance. I had seen him briefly a few months before, and remembered his face, and nothing in his neat and professional correspondence with me had implied illness. Now he was drawn and pale, haggard in a way that caused his skin to look grey-yellow, his lips unnaturally crimson. His suit hung limply from his thin shoulders. He seemed drained of life. I tried to tell myself that I had merely been in a hurry during my first visit, and that my acquaintance with the man by post had made me more observant this time. But I couldn't shake the feeling of having seen him decay with the lapse of a short time.
Now, Dr. Rossi, I don't believe you realize what a valuable little item you had here all along. It's a rare example of Central European medieval printing. Very interesting and unusual thing, and I'm pretty well satisfied now that it was probably printed about 1512, perhaps in Buda or perhaps in Wallachia. It's even possible that the woodcut in your book actually influenced the Hungarian New Testament of 1520, which has a similar illustration, a winged Satan. It would be a funny influence, wouldn't it? I mean, to see part of the Bible decorated with illustrations anything like this diabolical one.
Diabolical? I relished the sound of the condemnation on someone else's lips.
Oh, sure. I mean, you filled me in on the Dracula legend, but do you think I stopped there?
Mr. Martin's tone was so flat and bright, so American, that it took me a moment to react. Never had I heard that sinister depth in a voice so perfectly ordinary. I stared at him, puzzled, but the tone was gone, and his face smooth.
It appears from the chemical analysis that this book was stored, probably for a long time, in an atmosphere heavily laden with stone dust, and that occurred before 1700. Also, the back section of it was stained at some point with salt water, perhaps from exposure to an ocean voyage. And that map, by the way, is remarkable.
Map? I froze. Only one map I knew of, three actually in graduated scale, had anything to do with my present intentions, and I was sure I had never so much as mentioned their existence to this stranger.
Did you sketch it yourself? I mean, it's not old, obviously, but I wouldn't have put you down as an artist, and certainly not a morbid type anyway, if you don't mind my saying that.
I stared at him, unable to decipher his words, and afraid to give something away by asking what he meant.
Well, I tucked it back in the book, so it's there.
He opened the door for me and smiled his professional grimace again. I saw, in the light of the corridor, that I must have imagined Martin's peculiar smile, and perhaps even his illness. He was normal-skinned, just a little stooped from decades of work among the leaves of the past, nothing more. Out in the fresh air of the mall, I strolled across the bright green grass to a bench, and sat down, trying both to appear and to feel unconcerned. The volume fell open in my hand with its usual sinister obligingness, and I looked in vain for a loose sheet of something to surprise me there. Only turning back through the pages did I find it, a very fine tracing on carbon paper, as if someone had had the third and most intimate of my secret maps actually in front of him, and had copied all its mysterious lineaments for me. The place names, in Slavic dialect, were exactly those I knew from my own map. Pig-stealing village, the Valley of Eight Oaks. In fact, this sketch was unfamiliar to me in only one particular. Below the appellation of the unholy tomb, there was some neat Latin lettering in an ink that seemed to match that of the other titles. Over the apparent location of the tomb, arched around it as if to prove its absolute association with that spot, I read the words, Bartolomeo Rossi. Reader, judge me a coward if you must, but I desisted from that moment. I'm a young professor and I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I lecture, dine out with my new friends, and write home to my aging parents every week. I don't wear garlic or crucifixes or cross myself at the sound of a step in the hall. I have a better protection than that. I have stopped digging at that dreadful crossroads of history. Something must be satisfied to see me quiet, because I have been untroubled by further tragedy. And yet, if you are reading this at all, it means that harm has finally come to me. Knowing my story, can you refuse me, sucker? Yours in grief, Bartholomew Rossi.
The shadows beneath the trees had lengthened to yawning proportions, and my father kicked at a chestnut burr under his good shoes.
Lord, what have we been talking about? How grim we seem to be this afternoon.
He tried to smile, but he also threw me a glance that spoke of worry. I had stayed away from the university library for some time, partly because I'd been feeling strangely nervous about my research there, and partly because I had the sense that Mrs. Clay was suspicious about my absences after school. Finally, however, the temptation was too great, and I decided to go back. This time I feigned an evening movie with a dull girl from my class. I knew that Johann Binetz worked in the medieval section on Wednesday nights, and that my father was at a meeting at the center. It was odd going to the library at night, especially since I found the main hall as full as ever of weary-looking university students. The medieval reading room was empty, however. I made my way quietly to Mr. Binert's desk. He had a volume set aside for me. Why hadn't I come in sooner for it? I apologized weakly, and he chuckled. I took the book gratefully, and Mr. Binert said he was going into his workroom and that I should call him if I needed anything. The reading room was quieter than ever when he had gone, but I eagerly opened the volume he'd given me. It was a remarkable find, I thought then, although I now know what a basic source it is for 15th century Byzantine history. A translation of Michael Dukas's Historia Turco-Byzantina. Dukas has quite a bit to say about the conflict between Vlad Dracula and Mehmet II. I remembered Sultan Mehmet's archive, the one Rossi had gone to Istanbul to explore. The Prince of Wallachia had been a thorn in the Sultan's side, that was clear. I thought it would be a good idea for me to read something about Mehmet. Perhaps there were sources about him that explained his relationship with Dracula. I had turned, with the idea of going to see where Mr. Binertz was, when I heard a noise from the back of the room. It was kind of a thump, more a vibration through the floor than an actual sound. Something made me start up in the direction of the impact, whatever it was, and I found myself dashing into the workroom at the back of the hall. There was a leg on the floor, a gray trousered leg attached to a twisted body, the blue sweater askew on the wrenched torso, the pale gray hair matted with blood, the face, mercifully half-hidden, crushed, a bit of it still on the corner of the desk. A book had apparently just fallen from Mr. Binnett's grasp. It lay sprawled, like him. On the wall above the desk there was a smear of blood with a large, fine handprint in it, like a child's finger painting. I tried so hard not to make a sound that my scream, when it came, seemed to belong to someone else. I spent a couple of nights at the hospital. My father insisted, and the attending doctor was an old friend. My father was gentle and grave, sitting on the edge of the bed, or standing by the window with his arms crossed, as the police officer questioned me. When the officer was gone, my father sat on the edge of my bed again and asked me for the first time what I'd been doing in the library. I explained that I'd been studying, and that I liked to go there after school to do my homework because the reading room was quiet and comfortable. I was afraid he might be on the verge of asking me why I'd chosen the medieval section, but to my relief, he lapsed into silence. I did not tell him that in the eruption of the library after my scream, I had instinctively shoved into my bag the volume Mr. Binertz had been holding when he died. The police had searched my bag, of course, when they'd entered the room, but they had said nothing about the book. And why would they have noticed it at all? There had been no blood on it. It was a 19th-century French volume on Romanian churches, and it had fallen open to a page on the church at Lake Snagov, endowed with magnificence by Vlad III of Wallachia. A few weeks later, my father said he thought it would be good for my nerves to take a trip, and I knew that he meant it would be better for him not to leave me at home. It would be the best possible moment on the Mediterranean coast, he said, after the hordes of tourists left, but before the landscape began to look barren. Breakfast on the terrace at Le Corbeau, where we stayed, was so good in the fresh morning air that I lingered there after my father had joined the other dock-suited men in the conference hall, taking out my books reluctantly and looking up often at the aquamarine water a few hundred yards away. In the course of this day, I would learn more algebra, some German verbs, read a chapter on the War of the Roses, and then what? Up on the dry cliff, I would listen to my father's next story. He would tell it unwillingly, looking down at the sandy soil, or drumming his fingers on rock quarried centuries ago, lost in his own fear. And it would be up to me to study it again, to piece it all together.
When I finished reading the last of Rossi's letters, I felt a new desolation, as if he had vanished a second time. I wondered if Rossi had had any premonition that in training me he might have been ensuring his own survival. I opened the faded packet again. The next three items were maps, as Rossi had promised, each drawn by hand and none of them looking older than the letters. Of course, these would be his own versions of the maps he had seen in the archive in Istanbul, copied from memory after his adventures there. Among the scattered village names on one of the maps, I saw a square marked by Rossi, the unholy tomb of one who kills Turks. Above this box was a rather nicely drawn little dragon, a castle crowning its head, and under it I read more Greek letters and Rossi's English translation. In this spot, he is housed in evil.
Reader,
unbury him with a word. I set the maps aside. It was terrifying to see them there, exactly as Rossi had described them, and stranger yet to see not the originals, but these copies in his own hand. The only items that remained to be examined were the notes in Rossi's hand and that small, sealed envelope I'd noticed on first turning through the papers. I had meant to leave the envelope for last because it was sealed, but I couldn't wait longer. I found my letter opener among the papers on my desk, carefully broke the seal, and drew out a sheet of notepaper. It was the third map again, with its dragon shape, curling river, towering caricature, mountain peaks. It had been copied in black ink, like Rossi's version, but the hand was slightly different. A good facsimile, but somehow cramped, archaic, a little ornate when you looked at it closely. I should have been prepared by Rossi's letter for the sight of the one difference from the first version of the map, but it still hit me like a physical blow. Over the box-like tomb site and its guardian dragon curved the words, Bartolomeo Rossi. I fought down assumptions, fears, and conclusions, and willed myself to set the paper aside and read the pages of Rossi's notes. The first two he had apparently made in the archives at Oxford and the British Library, and they told me nothing he had not already. Another page followed these, on a different notepaper, and this was marked and dated from his trip to Istanbul. These notes listed the Istanbul Library's holdings of documents from Sultan Mehmed II's time, at least whatever had struck Rossi as pertaining to his own research. The three maps, scrolls of accounts from the Carpathian Wars against the Ottomans, and ledgers of goods traded among Ottoman merchants at the edge of that region. The last item on the list from the archive took me by surprise. Bibliography, Order of the Dragon, partial scroll form. What surprised me about this jotting and made me hesitate over it was the fact that it was so uninformative. Usually Rossi's notes were thorough, self-explanatory. That, he liked to say, was the point of note-taking. Being in partial scroll form, it must be something ancient itself, I thought. Perhaps one of the library's holdings from the time of the Order of the Dragon. But why had Rossi not explained further? Had the bibliography, whatever it was, proven irrelevant to his search? With the exception of whatever lay in the scrolls of accounts, in the ledgers, and in that old bibliography, Rossi had been surprisingly thorough in sharing with me his discoveries, but I craved answers. I stood, my joints creaking, and went to my dismal little kitchen to boil some bouillon for soup. As I got down a clean pot, I realized that my cat had not come in for his supper, a meal I shared with him. He was astray, and I suspected that our arrangement was not wholly monogamous. But around supper time, he was usually there at my narrow kitchen window, peering in from the fire escape. I lifted the edge of the blind, pushed up the window, and called him, waiting for the thud of feline feet on the windowsill. I could hear only distant night traffic from the center of the city. I lowered my head and looked out. His shape filled the space, grotesquely, as if he had rolled there in play and then gone limp. I drew it into the kitchen with gentle, fearful hands, immediately aware of the broken spine and weirdly flopping head. Rembrandt's eyes were open wider than I'd ever seen them in life, his lips drawn back in a snarl of fear, and his front paws splayed and thorny. It would take a large and strong grip to kill such a creature. I touched his soft coat, rage welling under my terror. I had set him softly down on the kitchen floor, my lungs filling with a smoky hate, before I realized that under my hands his body was still warm. I whirled around, closed and latched the window, then thought frantically of my next move. How could I protect myself? The windows were all locked, and the door was double-bolted. But what did I know about horrors from the past? Did they leak into rooms like mist under the doors, or shatter windows and burst directly into one's presence? I found a clean towel in one of the kitchen drawers and gently wrapped my friend's body in it, laying him out in the front hall. I would have to bury him tomorrow, if tomorrow were going to come around the way it usually did. I sat down at the desk and cleared away Rossi's papers, putting them neatly in the envelope. I opened my dissertation notes across the center of the desk and propped up in front of me a pamphlet on merchants' guilds in Utrecht, a reproduction from the library, which I had yet to peruse. I picked up my pen and bent my head over the pamphlet. Never had I found it so difficult to concentrate. Every nerve in my body seemed alert to the presence outside, if it was a presence, as if my mind rather than my ears might be able to hear it brushing up against the windows. With an effort, I planted myself firmly in Amsterdam, 1690. I wrote a sentence, then another. I wrote down the name of the pamphlet's author to look up again later. Explore the significance of the city's printing presses for merchants, I noted. The printing presses might be extremely significant, I realized, forcing myself not to look behind me as I sat there, especially if the guilds had controlled some of them. I grew interested for a moment in spite of myself and tried to remember what I'd read about early publishing in Amsterdam and Utrecht. Suddenly, I felt a great stillness in the air, then a snapping of tension. I was breathing normally and my pen moved freely across the page. Whatever stalked me wasn't quite as clever as I'd feared, I thought, careful not to pause in my work. As I pretended to write, I reasoned with myself. The final threat to Rossi in 1931 had been his own name on the location of Vlad the Impaler's tomb. Rossi hadn't been found lying dead over his desk 2 days ago, as I might be soon if I weren't careful. He had been abducted. He might be lying dead somewhere, of course, but until I knew that for certain, I had to hope he was alive. Beginning tomorrow, I would have to try to find the tomb myself. I woke early the morning after I'd finished reading through Rossi's papers. I've never been so glad to see sunshine as I was that morning. The main hall of the library was very still, except for the echoing steps of librarians going about their business. Few students got here this early, and I would have peace and quiet for at least half an hour. I went into the maze of the card catalog, opened my notebook, and began pulling out the drawers I needed. There were several listings for the Carpathians, one on Transylvanian folklore. I found one book on vampires, legends from the Egyptian tradition. Then I looked up Dracula. Subjects and titles were mixed together in the catalog. Between Drab Ali the Great and Dragons Asia, there would be at least one entry. The title card for Bram Stoker's Dracula. There was nothing. Then I caught sight of what actually lay between Drab Ali and Dragons. A little shard of twisted paper at the bottom of the drawer showed clearly that at least one card had been wrenched out. I hurried to the ST drawer. No entries for Stoker appeared there, only further signs of a hasty theft. I sat down hard on the nearest wooden stool. This was too strange. Why would anyone have ripped out these particular cards? The dark-haired girl had checked out the book last. I knew that. If she hadn't committed this crime herself, then maybe she didn't know that someone else didn't want that book checked out. And she probably still had it in her possession. I almost ran to the main desk. There I addressed the librarian, trying not to seem ruffled. I'm looking for a book that's not on the shelves at the moment, and I wonder if it's actually checked out right now or on its way back. The librarian, a short, unsmiling woman of 60, glanced up from her work.
The title, please?
Dracula by Bram Stoker.
Just a minute, please. I'll see if it's in.
She thumbed through a little box, her face expressionless.
I'm sorry, it's currently checked out.
Oh, what a shame. When will it be coming back?
In 2.5 weeks. It was checked out yesterday.
I'm afraid I simply can't wait that long. You see, I'm teaching a course.